Sometimes I think I'll kill you. Just don't let me, will you? 'Cause when I need a friend, it's still you.
Hey kids, it's Krusty the Clown. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. Alright, where's my money? What? Chintzy college stations.
No matter how large or small your digging project may be, no matter how urban or rural, you must always call 811 before any digging project. 811 is our national one-call number, alerting your local utility companies to come out and mark any lines they have near your dig site. So before you do this or this, make sure you do this. For digging projects big or small, make the call to 811, brought to you by Common Ground Alliance.
Today, one in five Americans experience emotional and mental health challenges, but many of us don't know how to ask for help.
At the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, we work every day to eliminate stigma and advance mental health. Visit mentallyhealthynation.org to learn more.
WRCT Pittsburgh. It's more fun when it doesn't make any sense.
I'm the sun and the air. All the shyness that is criminally vulgar. I am some man of nothing in particular. Bishop Chamon.
Hello, this is Adam Clayton here, the bass player from U2. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM.
Yeah. do with you. I'm alive.
Thank you. When it comes to vaping, the truth can get clouded. So let's make it clear. Vaping is not safe for kids, teens, or young adults. It's just not.
Because vaping can put microscopic particles into your lungs.
And dangerous things like metals and volatile organic compounds into your body.
And nicotine, the same highly addictive substance found in regular cigarettes.
Nicotine can harm a person's brain development through their mid-20s.
Affecting learning, memory, attention, and impulse control. And priming the brain for other addictions.
Vaping products also come in kid-friendly flavors that can make them appealing to youth.
And many kids also use other drugs, like marijuana, in vaping devices.
With appealing flavors, high nicotine levels, and lots of promotion on social media,
many kids think vaping is harmless, but it's not.
So talk to your kids about the risks of vaping, because when you talk, they hear you.
For more information, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM.
This is Shannon Lee Reynolds. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, media are focused on public protests in Los Angeles, but seem less interested in exploring what's actually making people angry, which is in part the federal government's stated bid to capture and eject anyone they determine opposes U.S. foreign policy. Protesters and witnesses and journalists in L.A. aren't being shot at and thrown around and sent to the hospital because they disagree with U.S. policy, we're told, but because they're interfering with federal agents carrying out that policy. Do you see how that works? If you don't, and it worries you, you're far from alone. We'll hear from Chip Gibbons, Policy Director at Defending Rights and Dissent, about the critical case of Columbia University student activist Mahmoud Khalil, held without warrant in a detention facility in Louisiana since March for voicing support for Palestinian lives. There's an important legal development, but how meaningfully Khalil's case ultimately translates, just as with ICE sweeps around the country, will have to do with us. Also on the show, if the problem were to get rid of unhoused people, the answer would be to house them. It's cheaper than jailing people for being homeless, so if it's those taxpayer dollars you care about, that would be plan A. Why isn't it? We'll hear from Farah Hassan, policy analyst, writer, and adjunct professor in the Department of Political Science at Cal Poly Pomona. That's coming up. We're getting right to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. As we record on June 12th, the official death toll in Gaza is something that need not be of specific concern, given ample evidence that no number would in itself magically change the indifference of powerful bodies to the ongoing crime of murder, starvation, displacement, and erasure of Palestinians by Israel with critical U.S. material and political support. UN Humanitarian Chief Tom Fletcher said recently, without trying to compare his experience to that of Gazans, that he has started therapy to deal with his experience, just witnessing trauma on this scale. But when people speak up about something that bipartisan U.S. politicians and U.S. corporate media support, that criticism becomes suspect, by which is increasingly meant criminal. So here we are with Columbia University graduate, or what Fox News calls anti-Israel ringleader, Mahmoud Khalil, charged with no crime, but detained since March. Chip Gibbons is policy director at Defending Rights and Dissent and journalist and researcher working on a new history of FBI national security surveillance. Welcome back to Counterspin, Chip Gibbons.
It's always a pleasure to be back on Counterspin.
Well, there's always a lot I could talk with you about. But for today, I know that listeners with horrible news coming at them from all sides may have lost the thread on Mahmoud Khalil. What is the latest on his case, and how good is that latest news? What we should think about it?
Well, as of June 12th, when we're recording this, Mahmoud Khalil is still detained at the LaSalle Immigration Detention Center in Jenna, Louisiana. It is a private immigration prison. If you go on their website, they talk about their commitment to family values. But the conditions there, you'll be shocked to learn this, are not very good. I'm not sure what type of family values they're talking about. Recently, a judge has ruled on a preliminary injunction that Mahmoud Khalil brought, asking that the immigration provision that Rubio's relying on that gives the Secretary of State the power to expel someone from the country if they pose a threat to U.S. foreign policy is unconstitutional as applied to him, enjoin Rubio from enforcing it against them, voiding the determination that Rubio made, as well as enjoining the Trump administration from enforcing what Khalil's lawyers allege, and I think is not really just an allegation at this point, is a policy of arresting and detaining non-citizens who criticize Israel or support Palestinian rights. The judge has given the Trump administration until Friday to appeal and has stayed his own order. Of all the other similarly situated individuals in immigration proceedings over their pro-Palestine speech, the judges have granted them bail pending a final motion. Khalil submitted a motion for bail. It's never been ruled on. And now the judge has issued this injunction that could potentially set him free, but has given the government until Friday to file an appeal. And it's unclear if the government files the appeal, if that will further stay his time in detention. And Khalil is a father. His child was born. While he was detained, he was not able to attend the birth of his child. And for an extended period, he was denied a contact visit with the child, the newborn child, until a judge intervened. And the thing we have to remember here, and this is very difficult to keep track of, is that Khalil is really in two separate legal proceedings right now. He's in an immigration removal proceeding, which takes place in immigration court. And immigration court is not part of the quote-unquote Article 3, that's Article 3 of the U.S. Constitution, judiciary. It is part of the Department of Justice. Immigration judges work for Pam Bondi, the Attorney General. You can appeal an immigration judge's decision to the Board of Immigration Appeals, which is appointed by Pam Bondi, the Attorney General, and the Attorney General can reverse or modify any decision of the Bureau of Immigration Appeals. So immigration court is basically a kangaroo court. At the same time, he's challenging the constitutionality of his detention, not the removal itself, but the detention is unconstitutional in federal court with what's called a federal habeas petition. And the habeas corpus, of course, goes back to before the Magna Carta, but it was enshrined as a basic human right in the Magna Carta. And he's arguing his detention is unconstitutional. And the reason for these two proceedings is that immigration courts are very limited in what they can do beyond the sort of kangaroo court nature that I just described, where the attorney general is usually the party seeking the deportation and the person making the decision works for the attorney general. And if the attorney general doesn't like their decision, they can modify it. The Bureau of Immigration Appeals ruled during the Clinton years that once the Secretary of State makes a determination that someone's presence in the U.S. has adverse foreign policy consequences, they can be removed from the country. There's essentially no defense, and immigration judges cannot hear constitutional challenges or issues. On the flip side, federal courts are barred from hearing challenges to the Attorney General's enforcement or commencement of immigration proceedings, but they are allowed to weigh challenges to detention. So Khalil and other similarly situated defendants are using the habeas remedy to challenge their constitution out of the detention. In Khalil's case, it gets very complicated even further because the government has brought two quote-unquote immigration charges against him. Mm-hmm. One is the claim that his presence poses a threat to our foreign policy. The other is that he misled immigration officials on his application by not mentioning he was part of a student group, which is unclear why that would affect his green card. And there's also allegations about when he did or didn't work for the British government. He worked at the British embassy, I think, in Lebanon. And the Trump administration is bringing that up, I believe, was disclosed on his application. And his lawyers have offered information refuting this charge, but the immigration judge has refused to hear it. The immigration judge, by the way, not only works for the Department of Justice, she's a former ICE employee. She's refused to hear it on the grounds that she doesn't need to make a decision on it because she has the Rubio determination. And the preliminary injunction only applies, we think, to the Rubio determination because the judge ruled in a previous ruling he was unlikely to prevail on a constitutional challenge to the misleading application charge. So that's sort of the convoluted legal situation we're in.
Yeah,
Khalil
yeah.
is in a removal proceeding in immigration court. He's in a federal challenge to his detention in federal court, and a federal judge has issued an injunction to enforcing the Rubio determination against him, but not the second charge, which an immigration judge has refused to rule on. Rubio thing is the sole removal basis. And that judge has also issued a stay, giving the government time to appeal. So he remains detained, even though his detention is likely unconstitutional, and a judge has found that he suffers irreparable harm by this detention.
I want to lift up a piece that you mentioned that we're seeing, is that criminality, you know, or the ability to be detained or has to do with something you do having, quote, adverse foreign policy consequences, close quote. I know that folks hear that and are like, what? What do you mean? Like, you know, if the current administration has certain foreign policy objectives and I disagree with them, that means if I speak out in opposition, I'm committing a crime?
So I think we have to remember, and this gets sort of pedantic, but Khalil is not charged with a crime. And the provision is not a criminal provision. It is a provision about whether or not you can be admitted into the U.S. or removed from the U.S. So Khalil has not been charged with any criminal offense. They are invoking a provision that says if your presence has adverse foreign policy consequences for the United States.
Your presence. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Signs a piece of paper saying this is true or makes determination of it, you can be deported from the U.S. So this is not a criminal matter. What does this provision even cover or does not cover is a really fascinating question. And the judge in the Khalil habeas case has stated that it's unconstitutional as applied to Khalil because no reasonable person would have noticed that this provision could apply to domestic political speech or domestic speech. He noted a number of instances when it was used in the 90s by the Clinton administration, but they were all against people who were accused of criminal conduct in foreign countries. So you had a Saudi national who was accused of terrorism in Jordan. You had an alleged paramilitary leader from Haiti. You had a Mexican official who was accused of a number of crimes. But it was not someone who was in this country and engaged in political speech about a foreign government's genocide. And therefore, no reasonable person would have any notice that this statute could apply to their domestic speech.
Well, I'm going to keep us short for today, although there are much and myriad things we could talk about. But you and I both know that once politicians take up an individual case, Julian Assange, Michael Brown, Mahmoud Khalil, we know that then news media bring out the microscopes. Is this really a good guy? You know, how did he treat his mother? I'm seeing some parking tickets here. Like, there might be some particulars to investigate. There's almost a vocational effort to make there be something specific about this person that makes it make sense that they are being targeted. And then the effect of that is to tell everyone listening, as long as you don't do what this guy did, you're going to be safe. Why is the Mahmoud Khalil case so important to folks who don't even know who Mahmoud Khalil is and don't understand why it matters?
This is a case about whether or not we have a First Amendment right to criticize Israel for engaging in a genocide in Gaza or support the human rights of the Palestinian people. The case is currently about an obscure Cold War immigration provision and whether or not it can be used to deport a lawful permanent resident, all of which have profound legal questions for individuals in this country who are immigrants or non-citizens. But at the end of the day, we should not believe this will remain only in the non-citizen realm. The Heritage Foundation, who laid out a lot of the playbook about using deportations to target student activists, has made it clear their final goal is to equate all protests for Palestine with material support for terrorism. In the past, when we've seen immigration enforcement abused for political policing, J. Edgar Hoover during the Palmer raids, the Los Angeles Eight, who were supporters of Palestinian rights, who the Reagan, Bush 1, Clinton, and Bush 2 administrations sought to deport. Both of those cases pre-configure or sort of forebode larger attacks of civil liberties that eventually affect everyone, which is not to say that we shouldn't care about the rights of non-citizens. We should care about everyone's free speech rights. But if you believe this is going to stay with green card holders or student visa holders, the goal is to take away your right to criticize a foreign apartheid state genocide with the eventual goal of taking away your right to criticize U.S. foreign policy. And this is the vehicle for doing it. It starts today with the visa holders and the green card holders, but they will come for the natural born citizens eventually too, if they get away with this.
We've been speaking with Chip Gibbons of Defending Rights and Dissent. They're online at rightsanddissent.org. Chip Gibbons, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me back.
In 1999, then New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani declared that, quote, streets do not exist in civilized societies for the purpose of people sleeping there. Bedrooms are for sleeping, close quote. He added that the right to sleep on the streets, quote, doesn't exist anywhere. The founding fathers never put that in the Constitution, close quote. That absurd out-of-touchness, the failure not merely of empathy but of knowledge, our guest reports that still seems to undergird much of what we are told are policies and laws meant to address homelessness, including at the highest levels. Farah Hassan has been tracking the issue for years. She's a writer, policy analyst, and adjunct professor in the Department of Political Science at Cal Poly Pomona. She joins us now by phone from Sacramento. Welcome to Counterspin, Farah Hassan.
Hi, Janine. Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to ask you about Grants Pass v. Johnson, last year's Supreme Court case that you wrote about recently for Other Words. But I'd like to start, as you do, with the acknowledgement that ought to anchor every story we see, that a person who works full-time and earns a minimum wage cannot afford a safe place to live almost anywhere in the United States. That's the reality. That's the understanding that any of our responses ought to take on board or to be judged by, yes?
That's correct. I mean, we have to consider that backdrop if we are going to talk about the growing problem of homelessness and the related housing crisis. And unsurprisingly, homelessness has increased as our government has diminished social safety nets. And we have to consider that when we think about how people fall into homelessness.
Well, so rather than respond with a commitment to housing and social services and job and wage growth, what we've seen is criminalizing. I couldn't find it, but I remember Rudy Giuliani saying that he hoped that his crackdown on unhoused people would lead to them just going away, you know, like just sort of disappearing. And that seems to be some of the thinking behind, if not the Grants Pass ruling, some of the support for us. So tell listeners a little about what Grants Pass, that decision, did, and then what didn't it do?
Well, a year ago on June 28th, in the city of Grants Pass versus Johnson, the Supreme Court ruled that local governments can criminalize people for sleeping outside, even if there is no available shelter. The Supreme Court overturned the 2018 Martin versus Boise precedent that had been decided by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which had said that the Eighth Amendment's cruel and unusual punishment clause prohibits cities from penalizing unhoused people for sitting, sleeping, or lying outside on public property unless they have access to adequate temporary shelter. And so for some context, in Grants Pass, like other cities across the United States, the number of people living unhoused easily exceeds the number of available shelter on any given night. Deborah Blake was among those Grants Pass residents who was forced to live outside. In her case, for 8 years after losing her job and housing. Moreover, her disability disqualified her from staying in the town's only shelter. And the city had these anti-camping ordinances that prohibited people like Deborah Blake from sleeping or camping in the public. And they interpreted quote-unquote camping to even include the use of bedding, like a blanket, to stay warm in the cold. Anyone who violated these ordinances in the city could be ticketed, could face fines, even subject to criminal prosecution. And the Grants Pass City Council themselves revealed that the underlying goal of these ordinances was to, quote, make it uncomfortable enough for unhoused people in our city so that they will want to move down the road, unquote. And so in Deborah Blake's case, after being banished from every park, accruing thousands in fines, she sued the city of Grants Pass as part of his class action suit for violating unhoused residents' constitutional rights. And the Oregon District Court agreed in 2020 that the city's actions constituted cruel and unusual punishment. But sadly, Blake never got to see the results, and the city of Grants Pass ended up appealing this decision all the way to the Supreme Court, which ruled in the city's favor, and which brings us back to today. And I should also know, going back to the Supreme Court's decision, that importantly, it did not say, therefore, state and local governments must now criminalize homelessness. But because the High Court found Grants Pass's anti-camping ordinances constitutional, many jurisdictions, unfortunately, including in California, where I live, have used the court's decision as a green light to crack down on people living unhoused, including by passing these anti-camping ordinances similar to Grants Pass, which broadly criminalize the act of sleeping or pitching tents or other structures on publicly owned property.
Well, it's clear that the issues of homelessness involve many societal factors other than housing. And at the same time, there's an Occam's razor at work here. There's a reason that housing first lands as a call, isn't there? For people who think, well, it's very complicated, it's about mental health, it's about family structure or whatever, housing first makes a lot of sense if folks would just think of it that way. Yeah.
That's absolutely correct. There is a misconception that homelessness is primarily caused by addiction and mental illness, which is not to say, to be clear, that there are not people, right, suffering from mental illness and addiction among our nation's unhoused population. But there was this landmark study in June 2023 by the University of California, San Francisco, that focused on California. And it found that poverty and high housing costs are, in fact, the driving forces of homelessness. And that's just more confirmation that housing unaffordability is the primary cause of homelessness, as other research and experts have long noted. And that's why, therefore, using the findings of this evidence, punitive fines, arrests, sweeps of encampments do not address the root of the problem, which is, again, the absence of permanent, affordable, and I might add, adequate housing. And so there are more things our country can do instead of criminalizing homelessness, which only traps people into these cycles, these endless cycles of poverty and homelessness, not to mention criminal penalties being inhumane to begin with. And so housing first, as you mentioned, is one proven evidence-backed solution here. It prioritizes providing permanent housing as soon as possible to individuals and families experiencing homelessness without preconditions. It's in contrast to what some people just want, which is treatment first or treatment only. Housing first also is coupled with voluntary supportive services to help improve housing stability and well-being, especially for those people who may need additional support, additional treatment. And Housing First has strong bipartisan support for decades. It's been supported by the Department of Housing and Urban Development and other agencies. And there's so much evidence that shows that Housing First actually works, including in places like Houston, Texas, which notably reduced homelessness by nearly two-thirds over a decade. So that's just yet another example of why, instead of kicking people while they're down, housing support combined with other voluntary services really help to lift people back up.
Well, I'll just only ask you finally, Farah Hassan, if you see a particular role for news media here, either for good or for ill, in terms of consideration of this question, which I want to ground folks in the statement that you have in the piece: homelessness is solvable in our lifetime. It's not bending laws of nature, it's just informed effort, and I wonder what role you think news media might play there.
Oh, thank you. I really do appreciate that question, because underlying that question is, I believe, a larger narrative of how we talk about housing in this country. And you would never know that it's actually a well-defined and internationally protected fundamental human right that all people, not people who have to be means tested or meet certain qualifications, all people are entitled to. Why? Because we all know innately, looking at our own lives, that housing is essential to life, to health, to well-being. But in the United States, it has primarily treated housing as a commodity, and it's failing to protect this right for large numbers of people. Homelessness itself, the sheer fact that over 770,000 people last year experienced homelessness, a record high, directly violates this right to adequate housing. So we have to look at this as a government failure instead of constantly pointing back at people living unhoused and blaming them for their plight, as if there are not larger structural factors at play that contribute to housing remaining perpetually unaffordable for more and more people living in this country. And so obviously the U.S. doesn't recognize housing as a human right, but I believe we should talk about it more, like we do about the need for Medicare for all, which is rooted in health care for all. We need these economic, social, and cultural rights, along with civil and political rights, to really be able to live our lives to the fullest. And fundamentally, that means transforming our nation's approach to housing policies. And to remember that people shouldn't be punished as well as you look back on homelessness for living in public spaces. People should not be punished for existing.
I'm going to end on that note. We've been speaking with writer, policy analyst, and adjunct professor at Cal Poly Pomona, Farah Hassan. Farah Hassan, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much, Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the National Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin. Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, an email I got this week tells me, and I'll quote, "The radical left is up in arms about DOGE. Just think about it. DOGE has exposed billions in wasteful spending and is rooting out fraud and corruption at every turn. They're making the government work for the people of this great nation once again, as the founders intended. And that is why the left simply can't stand DOGE." End quote. The ask is that I fill out a survey that represents our once-in-a-lifetime chance to slash the bloated, woke, and wasteful policies in the federal government. Thank you and God bless, Speaker Mike Johnson, paid for by the NRCC and not authorized by any candidate or candidates committee. Reports are that Elon Musk is leaving government, going back to make Tesla great again or something. But if that's true, why did I get this weird, sad email? We'll talk about how to miss Musk when he won't go away with Jeff Hauser, executive director of the Revolving Door Project. Also on the show, the New York Times has its stories on the Boeing non-prosecution agreement in their business section, suggesting that whether planes drop out of the sky is mostly a concern for investors. A huge corporation paying money to dodge criminal charges.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!